Get up, man. Dial 911. This is Carla. What's your emergency?
Hi, this is an off-duty officer. Can I get, I need EMS. I'm in number. I'm an off-duty officer. I thought it was in my apartment, and I shot a guy thinking that he was, thinking it was my apartment.
30-year-old Amber Geiger made headlines around the country when on September 6th, 2018, she walked into the wrong apartment and shot and killed a man who was sitting on his couch watching TV. In her 911 call, Amber, a police officer with the Dallas Police Department, tells the dispatcher that she had thought she was walking into her own apartment and that she thought the man she had killed was an intruder.
You saw someone?
Yes, I thought it was my apartment. Oh my God. I'm sorry.
Okay, and where are you at right now?
I'm inside the apartment with him. Hey, come on.
What's your name?
I'm Amber Geiger. I need to get me. I'm in.
Okay, we have help on the way.
I know, but I'm going to lose my job. I thought it was my apartment. Yeah. I need a supervisor. Hey, bud. I thought it was my apartment. I could have sworn I parked on the third floor.
Okay, I understand.
I thought it was my apartment.
Okay, and what floor are you in right now?
The fourth floor. Hey, bud, they're coming, big bud. I'm sorry, man.
Okay, where was he shot?
He's on the top left. Oh, my God. I'm done. I didn't mean to. I'm so sorry. Stay with me, bud. I'm tired. Hurry.
I'm so tired, she says. Hurry. Two of her fellow officers then arrive. Amber meets them in the hallway.
Over here.
Okay, go ahead and talk to her.
No, it's me. I'm off duty. I thought they were in my apartment. I thought this was my floor.
The 911 call cuts off, but the two responding officers go inside the apartment with Amber. They take turns giving the man on the floor CPR. The man has a faint pulse, but he's unresponsive. He had been shot once in the upper torso. The man is 26-year-old Botham Jean, an accountant at PricewaterhouseCooper, an international accounting firm. He dies not long after help arrives. As news of the shooting makes its way to the majority of news stations around the country, practically everyone is left scratching their heads.
Tonight, Dallas police identifying one of their own who killed an unarmed man in his apartment.
Right now, there are more questions than we have answers.
How in the world did this happen? How does someone walk into an apartment that isn't theirs and immediately shoot and kill someone? Did race play a role, given that Amber is white and Botham Jean was black? And would there be consequences for the death of an innocent man? Stay tuned. Today's episode delves into the trial of Dallas police officer Amber Geiger. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 88. Amber Geiger was taken into custody and arrested 3 days after the shooting, on September 9th, 2018. She was charged with manslaughter. The following is from the arrest warrant affidavit. Note that some of these details will be in dispute at Amber's trial. Quote, the facts of the case are as follows. Complainant Jean is the resident tenant of apartment 1478. Geiger, who is a Dallas police officer, lives in the same apartment complex, directly beneath the complainant in apartment 1378. Apartment 1378 and apartment 1478 and their respective interior floor plans are in most ways identical or extremely similar to the exterior surroundings, structure, and description of each other. Complainant Jean was home alone when Geiger, who had just entered her shift but was still in her Dallas police uniform, arrived at the apartment complex and parked her vehicle on the fourth floor of the parking garage, which should correspond to the floor the resident lives on. Geiger entered the building and walked down the fourth floor hallway to what she thought was her apartment. She inserted a unique door key with an electronic chip into the door keyhole. The door, which was slightly ajar prior to Geiger's arrival, fully opened under the force of the key insertion. Upon the door being opened, Geiger observed that the apartment interior was nearly completely dark. Additionally, the door being opened alerted complainant Jean to Geiger's presence. Believing she had encountered a burglar, which was described as a large silhouette across the room in her apartment, Geiger drew her firearm, gave verbal commands that were ignored by complainant Jean. As a result, Geiger fired her handgun two times, striking the complainant one time in the torso. Geiger then entered the apartment, immediately called 911, requesting police and EMS, and provided first aid to complainant John. Due to the interior darkness of the apartment, Geiger turned on the interior lights while on the phone with 911. Upon being asked where she was located by emergency dispatchers, Geiger returned to the front door to observe the address and discovered she was at the wrong apartment. Geiger called 911 from her cell phone, requesting an ambulance and police to the offense location. Complainant Jean was transported to Baylor Hospital, where he died as a result of his injury. Geiger remained at the scene and informed the responding officers and the 911 operator that she thought she was at her apartment when she shot the complainant. Geiger believed she was in her apartment and confronted a burglar when she fired her handgun, striking and killing him. The warrant was signed by Texas Ranger David Armstrong. Amber was held on $300,000 bond and was then released. She was initially placed on administrative leave from her police department, but then 2 weeks later, she was fired. On September 13th, 7 days after his death, Botham Jean's family and friends laid him to rest. Hundreds of people attended his funeral, which was held at the Greenville Avenue Church of Christ in Richardson, Texas, a suburb outside of Dallas. On November 30th, 2018, a grand jury indicted Amber for murder. She pleaded not guilty, and her trial started in September 2019, a little over a year after Beau's death. Everyone would hopefully finally learn the full details of what had happened. Representing the state of Texas was the lead prosecutor, Jason Hermes. In his opening statements, he described Botham Jean, known as Beau, as a wonderful, decent, and kind man who was sitting inside his apartment in the sanctuary of his own home when he was killed. He said the evidence will show that Beau was sitting in his living room in shorts and a t-shirt, watching TV and eating a bowl of vanilla ice cream, when all of a sudden, Amber Geiger comes through his front door, uninvited. The light from the hallway must have flooded his apartment, he surmised. The noise from the door must have scared him to death. As he was trying to get up off the couch to find out what this intruder was doing, coming into his home, she was leveling off her gun, having acquired her target, he said. He said she shot at him twice, leaving Beau with no opportunity for de-escalation, no opportunity for him to surrender. One of the bullets hit him, although he said prosecutors don't know which one. The other bullet went past Beau, through his back wall, and into the darkness of the city behind. Thank God nobody else was hurt, he said. He told the jury that the bullet that hit Beau went through his body, going downward. It hit just above his left nipple, then went down into his heart, lung, stomach, intestines, until it finally rested between his stomach and back. He said the path the bullet took is very revealing. It's consistent with Beau having just been getting up from a seated position facing the door as Amber fired her gun. He surmised that the only other reason for the downward trajectory would be if Beau was in a cowering position. He told the jury that after Beau was shot, he took a couple steps and then fell to the ground, lying on his back, bleeding to death, alone with his killer.
So you might be asking yourself, as did we, how does Amber Geiger come to be standing over the dying Botham Jean, an unarmed man in his own apartment, having just shot him? Well, in order for us to get that answer, we began to work right away, reconstructing her day on September the 6th. So, we're going to get into that in a second, but I'm going to tell you the short answer is simply this. In the last 10 minutes of Beau's life, Amber Geiger made a series of unreasonable errors and unreasonable decisions and unreasonable choices. The kind of choices and decisions that only she could have stopped the errors from happening again and again and again, and she didn't. And for her errors, for her omissions, both of them paid the ultimate price.
He told the jury that Amber worked a 13.5-hour shift that day, but he noted that Amber sought it out, as officers often did, because the overtime pay is lucrative. He said Amber was a 5-year veteran and part of the crime response team, also known as the CRT, that she held a very distinguished position by being on that team. On September 6th, the SWAT team had requested assistance from the CRT. The SWAT team was going to a home to arrest three notorious robbers, and they wanted the CRT to secure the perimeter around the home while they did that. Nothing went wrong during the SWAT team operation, and after they had the suspects in custody, Amber and her team transported them to the police department so they could be interrogated. He noted that that's normal protocol for suspects to be arrested, handcuffed, transported to the police department, and interrogated, except if the suspect is a police officer. He said they aren't treated like that. But he would get more into that later. From 2:20 p.m. until 7:45 p.m., the CRT remained at the police station while detectives interviewed the suspects. Afterwards, Amber and the rest of the team took the suspects to the Dallas County Jail, which is a building behind the police department. They then did their paperwork for the day and headed home around 9:30 p.m. Hermes told the jury that Amber's partner at work was a man named Martin Rivera. He said Martin and Amber didn't just have a working relationship. They had been intimately involved for the last year, even though Martin was married and had kids. Martin didn't work the overtime that night. He had to leave after work to go to an event. But he and Amber texted each other throughout the early evening. He said after a 13.5-hour shift, Amber made plans with Martin. Text messages between the two were displayed on an overhead for the jury. "When can I come over?" Martin wrote. Amber replied, "You can come over after this." "Mm-hmm. Super horny today, too." To which Martin responded, "Me too." As Amber was leaving work that night at 9:29 p.m., she sent a text message to Martin saying that she was just barely walking out of the police station. She then sent a Snapchat message to Martin. It was an image of herself with the words, "Wanna touch?" Hermes told the jury that there was some sort of date planned and that at 9:38 p.m., Martin called Amber and they spoke on the phone for a total of 16 minutes and 44 seconds. Amber was on her way home at that point, and when she pulled into her parking garage, Hermes said she pulled her car over while they were talking. He said Martin will testify that they were just talking about the details of what happened with the suspects at work that day, but he said the prosecution believes that there was something much more because she had to pull over. Their conversation ended at 9:55 p.m., at which point he said Amber pulled back into the lane of traffic in the garage. At that point, he said Beau has less than 3 minutes and 44 seconds to live. So what happens in that next 3 minutes and 44 seconds, he asked. Amber failed to park on the floor she's supposed to. She drove up to the fourth floor and parked there instead of on the third floor. He said she failed to recognize that it's an entirely different perspective there on that floor, that the fourth floor is open air and the third floor is not. Amber had a key fob and used that to walk down the fourth floor hallway. Hermes said it's a long walk, about a minute or two, down hallways to what she thinks is her apartment. She walked past 16 different apartments and failed to recognize the number 4 on any single one of them. He explained that next to each apartment door, there's a lit-up sign with the apartment numbers on them, and that there are differences on the floors themselves, too. He said whatever was on her mind after that conversation with Martin consumed her entirely. She began missing obvious things, including the fact that Beau had a bright red floor mat outside of his door. Amber doesn't have a floor mat in front of her apartment at all. He said Amber stepped onto the red mat and placed her key fob in the door. Unfortunately for Beau, he didn't lock his door when he got home that night. In fact, he said the door may not have actually been shut completely. She could have just pushed it open. Amber immediately assumed that there was an intruder, and she departed from police protocol, he said, and decided to go in and engage. Even though Amber has a huge table that's right in her line of sight as the door opens, and Beau's apartment doesn't, even though Amber's apartment is neat and tidy and Beau's is cluttered, even though Beau smoked marijuana and his home smells like it, and hers doesn't. He then focused on Amber's 911 call.
She said, I shot a guy thinking it was my apartment. No threat. No recognition of danger. For Amber Geiger, mere presence of someone in her apartment that she thinks is hers means he has to die. And she executed that plan perfectly. She doesn't one time say, he was coming at me. She doesn't one time say, he had a weapon. She doesn't one time say, he was scaring me. He made me fear for my life. None of that. And that's when she would have said it. The reason is because it didn't happen. She shot Beau because she thought he was in her apartment. And that's it.
He said she repeated 19 times in the call that she thought it was her apartment, and never once that he presented any threat to her at all. Hermes also told the jury that instead of doing damage control during the 911 call, she should have been providing CPR or comforting Beau during his last moments. But instead, while she was on that 911 call and in the room with Beau, he said she texted Martin at 10:02 p.m. and told him, I need you, hurry. Then, a minute later, at 10:03, she writes, I fucked up. This is Amber Geiger thinking about herself, Hermes said. He told the court that all of the text messages and a whole lot more were deleted off of her phone in the day or two after the shooting. He said it was only because they acted so quickly were they able to preserve this bit of information to show the jury.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we're done this trial, it is my hope and I have the conviction that we are going to have proven this case to you beyond a reasonable doubt that on September the 6th of 2018, Amber Geiger shot an unarmed man in his home who was doing no harm to anybody. And there will be nothing in law that you will find that justifies her in doing this. When that is the case, the state of Texas is entitled to a verdict of guilty. Because for this kind of crime, there must be a consequence.
In their opening statements, Amber's attorney, Robert Rogers, called what happened nothing short of an epic tragedy. He said it was the perfect storm of innocent circumstances that all came together and caused it. He said Amber firmly and reasonably believed that she was in her own apartment and that she had confronted an intruder in her apartment. He said she believed that she had no choice but to use her gun to keep from dying. He told the jury about Amber's background and said she had a reputation of being a hard worker. He said she knows how to talk to people and empathize with them, and that she wanted to be a cop so she could arrest the bad guys and help victims who truly needed them. He acknowledged that Amber had fallen for her partner, Martin, but said it has nothing to do with what happened. He told the jury that Amber had moved into the apartment complex, which is called the Southside Flats, In July 2018, just 2 months prior to the shooting, he said it was a confusing place, that none of the floor numbers in the parking garage were clearly marked, that you had to drive around and park by memory. He said Amber parking on the wrong floor and going to the wrong apartment was not selfish or evil. After working 13 and a half hours that day, he said Amber was tired. He noted that the prosecution didn't show a text message she had sent to Martin telling him that she was sleepy. He said she had even asked her supervisor for a day off the next day because she was so tired. She had worked 40 hours in 4 days doing different responsibilities of a police officer. He said she was tired and was going to go home and not have to work the next day. He told the jury that it was just speculation that she was going to meet up with Martin later that night.
Now, this speculation that her and Martin had a plan to hook up and be with other that night is rank speculation. There is nothing to that, and there is no evidence of that. Her and Martin, and Martin will tell you, they engaged in flirtatious banter all the time. The last time that they had been together sexually was well before this, sometime in late 2017, was the last time, and we're in September of 2018. So they hadn't had a sexual encounter in months. So to say that it was ramping up is wrong. It's false. It's the opposite. It was ramping down. Amber was trying to move on. She's a 30-year-old female. The relationship with Martin wasn't going anywhere. They were good work partners, and she liked flirting with him. But she was looking for more stability or for someone who was more available for her.
Rogers then explained what happened when Amber got to Beau's door.
Amber Geiger's fishing her keys out. She gets her keys out, and she gets to the door, and the door looks like her door. She didn't look down at the floor mat. It's reasonable to say that if she looked down and saw a red mat, she would have thought, and then looked up at the numbers. To say that she was aware there was a red doormat and knowingly ignored it because she wanted to go into 1478 and shoot this man is preposterous. Amber Geiger was in autopilot. She got to the door and she put her key fob in, and in one motion, the door is opening. And it doesn't make sense because normally you have to turn the handle. And she's trying to process this as she's stepping into her apartment. And at the same time, I'm sure Mr. John is thinking, what is this person doing? Who is coming to my apartment? So he's confused. He's wondering what's going on. She's thinking, what is going on? Why is this man in my apartment? And she looks up, and he's standing up. He's about 30 feet away from her. And I'm sure he's alarmed. But she's thinking, oh, my God, there's an intruder in my apartment. And she's face to face with him. She's within 10 yards of him, and he starts approaching her. And she reacts like any police officer would who has a gun with confronting a burglary suspect.
He said when Amber pulled her weapon, she expected the man to stop what he was doing, but he didn't. Instead, he was yelling and coming at her. He said Beau was coming towards her and that he wasn't sitting where the prosecution said he was. He said it's likely that Beau saw the gun and leaned down and got shot. He said the first thing Amber did when she realized the horrible, horrible mistake she had made was to call 911. He said she knows she messed up and made a tragic mistake, but it's not out of evil or out of recklessness or criminal state of mind. He closed by saying that the prosecution is holding Amber to an impossible standard, making things that are innocent mistakes into evil acts. The first witness for the state was Alyssa Findlay, Beau's older sister by 9 years. She said she used to speak with him on the phone or by text every single day. Their family grew up in St. Lucia, an island in the Caribbean, and that both she and Bo moved to the U.S. after being accepted at universities here. She said Bo graduated with a double major in accounting and management information systems. He then interned at PricewaterhouseCooper before accepting a full-time position with them. She said he was very excited at how his career was going.
He was always a happy person. He loved having fun. He was a fun-loving person, always saw the greener side of everything.
She spoke with him on the day he died. She recalled that he was happy. His birthday was coming up, and they talked about presents. She was going to get him a pot and pan set. Prosecutor Hermes asked her if she knew that Bo smoked marijuana, and she said yes. When he was in college, he was diagnosed with ADHD and was prescribed Adderall. He had started taking the Adderall, but he didn't like how it made him feel, and so he started smoking marijuana instead. When he smoked, she said he was mellow, the same Bo, he would just laugh more. On the night he died, Bo told her that he was going to watch the football game. It was the first game of the NFL season. He had a fantasy football league team and was excited to watch. She recalled receiving a phone call from a social worker at Baylor University Hospital a little after midnight. They told her that Bo was brought in with a gunshot wound and that he succumbed to his injuries.
At first, I didn't believe it because it was just not anything that I would expect. When I got the call, I thought maybe it was a car accident. So I wasn't expecting to hear that he was shot. I know I just immediately became cold. It just didn't make sense to me.
She said she still doesn't think she has accepted it today. She still calls his number to see if he'll answer. She said she misses him every single day. Amber's partner, Martin Rivera, testified that Amber was acting normally on the day of the shooting. She didn't seem tired nor absent-minded. He told the jury that he and Amber went from being just partners to being intimate sometime in 2017. He said their intimate relationship lasted until about the end of that year. Prosecutor Hermes showed him a text message from February 2018 between the two that was sexual in nature, and Martin acknowledged that he was wrong, that it must have gone into 2018. In September 2018, he said they would still send each other provocative photos, even though they were no longer intimate. Around 5:56 p.m. on the night of the shooting, he acknowledged that they sent text messages to each other about getting together, but he said they didn't have any plans for that night. Prosecutor Hermes told Martin that he had pulled their phone records and that their phone calls were normally short, around 1 or 2 minutes. But on the night of the shooting, their call was over 16 minutes. Martin said, to the best of his recollection, that he asked Amber about the suspects to see if they ever confessed, but he doesn't remember a whole lot else about their conversation. He assumed that she was driving home at the time, and he was just leaving a restaurant and going home. He was asked if he was aware that Amber had pulled over to the side of the garage during their conversation, and he said no. He doesn't know why she would have done that. Martin told the court that he got home just before 10 that night. He wasn't by his phone initially when Amber sent those text messages to him about needing him and to hurry. He said he didn't know that she was on the phone with 911 when she sent them. He was asked if a citizen was dying and he was the only one there to help, if he's trained to provide basic emergency care, and he said yes.
What is your job if you're the only one there who can render aid? What should you be doing?
Exactly that.
Anything else?
If you can, try to call for help.
But you're already on the phone, or you've already let your dispatcher know that you need to have medical personnel and so forth coming to the rescue. Should you be giving 100% of your attention to the person who's dying in front of you, if you can?
Yes, you should.
Should you be sending text messages?
No.
He was asked if he knew why Amber had deleted their text messages, and he said no. He was then asked why he deleted them from his phone.
Several reasons. That's not something that I would want to be reminded of, the speaking of the night. I don't keep messages saved unless it's of an importance to me.
Okay. So your partner was involved in a shooting. You know she's going to be investigated. Are you telling us that you deleted those messages?
I did.
On cross-examination, Martin said after he received the text messages from Amber that night while she was on the phone with 911, he called her back.
What was her demeanor?
She sounded like she was in a panic.
Was she crying?
I don't remember crying. Just remember her speech was very rapid, talking very fast.
And was this different than you've seen her in high-stress situations when you've arrested murderers and robbers and child molesters?
Yes.
So you knew from her demeanor and the tone of her voice that something serious had happened?
Yes.
Martin told the court that nothing sticks out to him about the phone conversation he had with Amber when she was in her parking garage. He said his plan was to stay home that night because he had to work the next morning. Officer Michael Lee, along with Officer Blair, were the first officers to arrive at the apartment complex. Footage from the body camera Officer Lee was wearing that night was shown to the jury. It started recording at 10:02 p.m. The officers run through the complex, up the stairs to the fourth floor. They encounter Amber in the hallway, right outside apartment 1478. I thought it was my apartment, she says as soon as she sees them. I thought it was my apartment. They ask where she shot him, and she says, top left, top left. Officer Lee testified that when he got inside the apartment, Beau was lying on the ground and he wasn't alert or conscious. He and Officer Blair immediately began CPR on him and continued until EMS arrived. As a citizen, would you expect anything less from our police officers? Prosecutor Hermes asked him. No, sir, he replied. Officer Lee told the jury that there were ear pods next to Beau's head, and he said it's possible that they could have fallen out as they were performing CPR. Still images from the body cam were displayed for the jury. There was a bowl of ice cream next to the couch, an open laptop next to it. The big screen TV across from the couch was on. Officer Lee was asked about how police officers are trained to deal with this sort of situation.
I want you to presume that you can safely, tactically reposition to a position of cover and concealment. Okay, you have, let's say that you have that option.
Okay.
Or you can just shoot him dead and then figure it out later. What do you do?
You cover and concealment.
Is that because of the sanctity of human life?
Yes, sir.
If you can safely retreat to a position of cover and concealment and get backup, do you think that would be better or worse for your safety or for the safety of the person inside?
Better.
On cross-examination, Officer Lee told the jury that he had been to the apartment complex several times and that the hallways often smell like marijuana. Officer Lee also agreed with Amber's attorney that the apartment numbers are harder to see than at other apartments. They're in a white light on a white background and are up and to the left of the door instead of being clearly marked on the door. He said Officer Blair had to stop and look up at the numbers because he wasn't sure where he was going. Officer Lee described Amber's demeanor as very emotional. Officer Tori Duga was another officer who responded to the scene. He testified that he got an officer assist call which he said means that an officer is in need and that they need to go there immediately with lights and sirens on. They entered through the parking garage, and he told the jury that there was only one entrance in and out. The garage has a gate that is locked and secure, and he noted that it would be difficult for a stranger to get in. Sergeant Brianna Valentine testified that the call first came in at 10:01 p.m. as a shooting. She was at a local 7-Eleven at the time, and as she was responding to the scene, she heard someone on their radio say, "Shouldn't this be an assist?" which would mean that an officer is in trouble. She did not know what had happened when she arrived. She told the court that the door to apartment 1478 was ajar and that there were a set of keys dangling in the door. She was about the third or fourth officer to arrive, and Amber was inside the apartment when she got there. She said she immediately recognized that it was an officer-involved shooting, and so once the second sergeant arrived, she took Amber downstairs to take her away from the scene. A still image from Sergeant Valentine's body camera was shown to the jury. Amber is seen in the hallway, and Sergeant Valentine testified that it appeared as though she was on her phone. Prosecutor Hermes asked her, "If you were to come upon a scene and there was a dead person on the ground and you know who shot him and you don't know what the circumstances are, is that person being taken into custody?"
"I wouldn't say always custody until you determine that that is the person that committed the offense."
"Okay, and once you've determined that person has cause for the person to be dead, is that person going to be detained and taken into custody for investigation?"
"Yes."
Earlier, Sergeant Valentine had said she took Amber away from the scene to be secluded, and Prosecutor Hermes asked what the benefit of doing that is.
It keeps other people from hearing conversations and from being able to access anybody else.
"Is it important to you to maintain seclusion so that stories can't be changed?"
"Correct."
Sergeant Valentine said that when she brought Amber downstairs, she left her alone by herself while she went to go bring her car around. The car's dash cam video was played for the jury. When Sergeant Valentine gets her car and pulls up to where she had left Amber, Amber can be seen surrounded by about four people. One of those people gives her a hug. Sergeant Valentine then goes to get her and tells her to get inside the front passenger side of her car.
"As far as your efforts to seclude her, would you agree that prior to you doing that, she has not been secluded?"
"That's correct."
"And do you even know who those people are?"
"At the time, I did not. And when I went to get my squad car, I did not see them. But when I pulled my squad car up, I did."
"Okay. Do you know who those people are now?"
"I do now."
"Who are they?"
"They are officers."
"Okay. Are they friends of hers?"
"To my knowledge, yes."
"Are any of those members, do you know, with the Dallas Police Association or the Dallas Union?"
"That I don't know."
Prosecutor Hermes pointed out that she was not secluded from others and that she was, in fact, talking with other officers. In that last clip, he then asked Sergeant Valentine if any of those officers were from the Dallas Police Association or the DPA, and she says she's not sure. The defense objected to that line of questioning, and the jury was removed from the courtroom while the attorneys argued. Amber's attorneys told the judge that the reason representatives from the DPA showed up is because there are lawyers that contract with them. They argued that the line of questioning is a comment on Amber's Sixth and Fifth Amendment rights to have an attorney, and so any comments on that are improper. They also argued that it's not relevant and is prejudicial. But Prosecutor Hermes argued that the standard practice that has been testified to is that a suspect is typically confined so that their stories can't be changed or fabricated, that they're placed away from other individuals, and that was not the practice here. He also pointed out other things that were outside of the normal protocol. For example, multiple officers told Amber not to talk when she was being put into Sergeant Valentine's car. He said she was made aware that the in-car recording system was rolling, something, he said, that is not common for anyone else. Prosecutor Hermes said that after Amber was put into the car, the president of the DPA showed up. He then told Sergeant Valentine to turn off the in-car video, and she did. He then walked over to the car, opened the door, and he and Amber then walked out of the view of the camera. Hermes noted that that was also a big deviation from what would be allowed in any other case. He argued that because of all of this, it shows that the investigation from the very beginning treated Amber differently because she was a police officer. He said it has a bearing on the partiality or impartiality of those investigations. The defense countered that none of those circumstances were in their client's control, that Amber didn't ask for any of that. Judge Tammy Kemp asked Sergeant Valentine if the DPA president, who is also a sergeant, outranks her, and she said yes. Was she required to follow his direction in turning off the in-car recorder? Judge Kemp asked. Sergeant Valentine said it wasn't given as a direct order. On the video, he motions something to her and then says something the camera can't hear. Then Sergeant Valentine goes into the car and turns it off. Judge Kemp asked Sergeant Valentine if she believed that she was departing from protocol by doing that, and she said no. She believed that Amber had been on duty at the time of the shooting, and so she thought that Amber was speaking with her supervisor, which would not normally be recorded. She only later learned that Amber had been off duty. She admitted that it had been a mistake and that if she had known that Amber was off duty at the time, she would have left the recording on. Still outside the presence of the jury, the footage from inside the car, before it was switched off, was shown. Amber can be seen sitting in the front passenger seat, and it appears as though she is texting on her phone. After a couple minutes, it looks like someone opens the door and says something to her. A couple more minutes go by. Someone opens the car door again, and she gets out and closes the door behind her. Sergeant Valentine then turns the in-car recording off, while Amber goes to talk to someone off-screen. In another angle, while Amber is sitting in the car, the paramedics come out with Beau on a stretcher. One of the paramedics can be seen giving him CPR on the ground, not far from where Amber sits in the car. When Amber gets out of the car to talk to someone off-screen and then goes back to the car, she can also be seen talking to multiple officers. Sergeant Valentine acknowledged in court that she had made a mistake by leaving Amber alone while she brought her car around. When the judge asked if she would have ever left a civilian standing alone like that, she said no. She would have walked them to her car. Judge Kemp ruled, however, that the jury would not hear any of this, and the trial continued. The state's next witness was 28-year-old Joshua Brown, who lived in apartment 1437, directly across from Beau's at the time of the shooting. He told the court that he had just met Beau earlier that day, around 1 or 2 in the afternoon. Someone from the building's leasing office had knocked on their doors, saying they had a noise complaint. He said it was odd because he didn't hear any noise. He met Beau because Beau had come out of his apartment at that time, too. He said they talked about how they had both been smoking weed and how the building management people were probably coming to the door due to that and not noise. Joshua said he went to a bar later that night to watch the football game and then took a lift home around halftime. As he was walking down the main hallway to his apartment, he said he heard what sounded like two people meeting each other by surprise. He said he couldn't make out what either one of them was saying, but there were two separate voices.
Like two voices mixing together at the same time so that I couldn't make out what either one of them was saying.
Do you recall ever hearing someone say, "Hey, put your hands up," in a loud tone?
No, ma'am.
Or, "Show me your hands."
No, ma'am.
Or giving any type of those other commands that you would hear police say on TV?
No, ma'am.
Then, right after, he heard two gunshots go off. He said when he heard the shots, he ran out of there, back into the garage. He saw some neighbors come out and he asked them if what he had heard were gunshots, and they said yes. He waited about 2 minutes and then walked back to his apartment. He didn't see anyone as he let himself inside. He checked on his dog, turned the football game on, and went over to the balcony. He said about 2 to 3 minutes later, he saw who he identified as Amber, whom he had never seen before, coming out of Beau's apartment. He said she was on the phone, crying and saying that she thought someone had broken into her apartment. He then went to the front door and looked out the peephole. He could see Amber walking back and forth while on her phone. She went back inside Beau's apartment at one point and then came back out. While he was on the balcony, he could see officers approaching in the courtyard. Amber met them in the hallway. Even though he had only met Beau that day, he said he would always hear him singing every morning. He would sing gospel music and Drake. As he recalled this, he became emotional and started crying on the stand.
We can take him on, Joshua. This is fine. We're not in a rush, okay?
Yeah, we need a moment.
He said he needed a moment, and the court took a short recess.
All right.
Ronald Jones was a coach and chemistry teacher who also lived in the Southside Flats back in September 2018. On the night of September 6th, he said he had been at a JV football game after work and he came home afterwards. The prosecution showed surveillance video from the parking garage, which showed him pulling in minutes after Amber, right at 9:53 p.m. He said he parked on the fourth floor. Then, as he was getting out of his truck, he saw a white pickup truck that was driving fast around the corner. He said it caught his eye because they were driving so fast. The truck then backed into a parking space near his. The person who got out of the truck was a female police officer. He said he noticed her because he had never seen a police officer on his floor before. He went into his apartment and was about to make himself something to eat when he heard two gunshots. A few minutes later, he heard a female voice saying, "There was someone in my apartment," and she kept repeating it. The prosecution also called more neighbors to the stand to testify about what they saw and heard that night. Bharath Madamanchi was on a Skype video call with his father, who lived in India, when he heard the gunshots. He said he didn't hear any verbal commands prior to that. Tadra Jones was sitting on her couch watching TV when she heard the shots. She said she didn't hear any noise before that either. Whitney Hughes testified that she was watching TV and painting her nails when she heard two loud bangs. She said when she looked through her peephole, she saw Amber in the hallway on the phone. She was at first concerned that she should call the cops, but when she saw Amber in her uniform, she assumed that they were already there. She said Amber sounded upset while she was on the phone, although she couldn't hear anything that was said. She also testified that she had some issues with her door shutting and locking. Alyssa Kinsey testified that her patio was about 8 inches away from Beau's. She recalled meeting him the day she first moved in. She was out on her patio and he came out and they started chatting. She said on the night of September 6th, she was sitting on her couch in her living room, FaceTiming with her boyfriend, when they both heard two very loud metallic sounds. She said she was shocked because it's a safe complex and she knows or has talked to most of her neighbors. She then heard a commotion, yelling or slamming or something like that in the hallway. She said she ran to the front door to look out of her peephole, but didn't see anything. It was silent for about 10 seconds, and then she could hear a female calling 911. It was muffled, but she could hear the woman say, "Apartment 1478," and then "shot." She then went to her patio to see if she could see anything, and she saw that the lights were on in Beau's apartment. She said to her boyfriend that she wondered if she should knock on his window to see if he had heard anything. Her boyfriend told her to just go back inside, and so she did. Once the officers arrived, she heard them say something about CPR, where a stretcher was, and she could hear what she said was a female hyperventilating. Alyssa also told the court that one time she too parked on the wrong floor. She said she was on the phone with her boyfriend and was distracted, and instead of parking on the fourth floor, she parked on the third floor, although she said she never went to the wrong door. Chanel Blee lived on Amber's floor. She testified that she heard the gunshots, but to her, it sounded more like a car backfiring. She told the jury that in September 2018, she had a very tall, large vase and a bright colored mat outside of her apartment door. This would be on Amber's typical path from the parking garage to her apartments. Texas Ranger David Armstrong, who you might remember as the person who signed Amber's arrest warrant, testified that he was the lead investigator in the case. He said that Beau's car arrived in the garage that night at 9:27 p.m., and he put his key in the lock of his apartment at 9:34 p.m. Amber entered the parking garage at 9:46 p.m. But although Ranger Armstrong was a witness for the state, he seemed to be more of a witness for the defense. On cross-examination, he said the layouts of Amber's and Beau's apartments were exactly the same. Their TVs and couches were in the same spot. He described when he first went to the apartment complex.
The first time I arrived at the apartment complex, there were no clear, obvious visual signs showing what level you were on.
The first time you went, you didn't see any readily available visual indicators. What, as you eventually found, were the only visual indicators of what garage floor you're on?
On the instep, or on the frame of each elevator, there is a small black placard that has the level number on it. And as I drove by, I would look for that placard, and it would display what garage level you were on. That was the only visual indicator that I had.
Is that something you had to be looking for?
Yes.
And did you ever park on the wrong floor?
Yes.
Just in the course of your investigation, you unintentionally parked on the wrong floor?
I did.
With regard to going from the garage to the interior of the complex, what visual indicators are there to let someone know what floor they're on?
There are none.
He said the complex has since added a placard with a number on it that indicates which floor you're on. Ranger Armstrong also testified that he conducted a survey of tenants at the complex to find out how many of them had also walked into the wrong apartment. He said they interviewed 297 out of 349 residents. Of those, 15% or 46 residents on all floors had actually gone to the wrong apartment and put their key in the wrong lock. A higher percentage of those lived on the third and fourth floors, 23%. With regard to just unintentionally going to the wrong floor, he said 31% of the tenants on all floors had done that. A higher percentage of those, again, lived on the third and fourth floors, 44%. He said that data was absolutely significant to his investigation. Ranger Armstrong also told the jury that there was a structural flaw in Beau's door that caused it to occasionally not latch all the way. The defense wanted Ranger Armstrong to give his opinion on where Beau was when he was shot and also to testify about the reasonableness of Amber's actions. With the jury outside of the courtroom, Ranger Armstrong testified that he did not have any evidence that Beau had been sitting on the couch when he was shot. And he said he also did not believe that Amber had committed a crime.
Today, you're telling us that based on everything and based on your training and experience, you don't believe there's even probable cause that Amber Geiger committed any crime, correct?
That's correct.
Also with the jury outside of the courtroom, additional body cam video was shown where the responding officers are giving Beau CPR. Beau's family started crying when they saw that, and Judge Kemp profusely apologized for playing it in front of them, saying she hadn't given any thought to the victim's family, the alleged victim's family, she said. Judge Kemp then ruled that Ranger Armstrong would not be allowed to give his opinion on where Bo was shot or whether he thought Amber was reasonable with her actions. Dr. Chester Gwynn, the medical examiner in the case, testified that Bo died from a gunshot wound that went from the chest down to the abdomen. Using a dowel rod, Prosecutor Hermes demonstrated the downward direction the bullet traveled through Bo's body. Dr. Gwynn testified that he could not tell where the shooter was or where Bo was when he was shot. Prosecutor Hermes pointed out that the trajectory shows that he must have been hunched over forward. Dr. Gwynn also testified about the toxicology tests. He said there was marijuana or THC present in Bo's body. Robin Carr, a crime scene analyst who took a photo of Amber after the shooting, testified about items Amber had in her belt, including her gun on one side, magazines, a taser, pepper spray, and her radio. Officer Tu Minh Nguyen was also one of the first responding officers the night of the shooting. He testified that when he arrived on the scene, he propped Bo's legs up with a pillow in order to get blood pumping to his heart. He said he also moved Bo's sandals that he had been wearing towards the door to get them out of the way. This was an important piece of testimony for the prosecution, since the defense's argument was that Bo had been moving it towards Amber, and his shoes being closer to the door could have supported that. Detective Stephen Cleary testified about the differences between Bo's apartment and Amber's. He noted that there was a bright red floor mat in front of Bo's apartment and no floor mat in front of Amber's. Amber's TV was bigger. There was artwork behind Bo's couch and none behind hers. Bo had a rug in his living room and a coffee table, and Amber did not. Bo had a large round ottoman, and Amber did not. And there was a half-circle entry table with a vase of flowers on it in Amber's apartment that was not in Bo's. Detective Cleary also compared the floors of the parking garage and said the roof line was visible from the fourth floor and wasn't visible from the third. Texas Ranger Michael Adcock testified that he used a 3D laser scanner on Bo's apartment to show what Amber's view may have been when she first walked inside. According to Ranger Adcock, she could have seen into the living room from the front entrance. Ranger Adcock also examined Amber's uniform and boots. He said there was no blood found on her uniform and that it appeared to be clean. There were also a pair of blue latex gloves found in Amber's pocket, and those tested negative for blood too and didn't appear to have been used. Michael Grice, an independent criminal investigator, was among the last witnesses for the state. He testified that the red mat in front of Bo's door had not been collected by evidence technicians 3 days after the incident. He had concerns that it may not be available, and so he obtained a search warrant, collected it, and brought it back to the DA's office. The defense called Amber Geiger to the stand, with her attorney, Toby Shook, questioning her. Amber told the jury that she was born in Arlington, Texas, the youngest of three children. She described how she played musical instruments in high school and that she always wanted to become a cop. She said she and Martin Rivera became partners when she joined the CRT. She said she looked up to him. He was older, had a lot of experience, and she felt safe and comfortable around him. Their close working relationship became a sexual one that not many people knew about. She said she was embarrassed because he was married. They were intimate about once a month, and they used to send each other sexually explicit messages. It was a routine between the two of them. That part of their relationship lasted for a year at the most, she said. It ended in late 2017 or early 2018. She said she knew it was morally wrong and she didn't want to hurt anyone, but they remained close and continued sending each other flirtatious texts and photos. Amber was then asked about the area in which she lived and if she knew about crime there.
There would be a lot of robberies and a lot of break-ins in that area.
Did you ever encounter people on the property that gave you some concern at times?
Yes, I did. There would be a lot of times when I was driving into work that there would be people, or like homeless people, passed out on the patio chairs in the pool area.
Any idea how they were able to gain access?
They would jump the fence. It wasn't that high of a fence, so that's how they would get in.
She said she used to even carry a pocket knife with her when she walked her dog, Ranger. She described her typical week as working from 8 to 4 Monday through Friday and working part-time on Sunday mornings at First Baptist Church. She said she usually went to bed around midnight. On the week of September 6th, she said she got an email about building maintenance going into their apartments. So she took her dog to her mom's house that previous Sunday because she didn't want him there when the maintenance guy came. She woke up at 5:30 a.m. on September 6th to go to work. She said the robbery suspects that the SWAT team arrested that day were armed and were very violent. She called it a tense situation and said if one of them had run out of that house, she and the rest of her team would be responsible for running after them. She said it took the suspects an hour or more to come out, but they eventually did after the SWAT team used tear gas. She was asked about text messages between her and Martin, where they talked about him coming over. She said that was normal, but there was never a plan for Martin to come over that night. She said he had never been to her house before, and she had no idea if he even knew where she lived. She said Martin texted her later and wanted to know how everything was going, and that there was nothing unusual about that. Later, as she was still at work, she said she texted Martin that she was sleepy. She said she was really tired that day. She and Martin continued texting, and she sent him an explicit photo, and he eventually called her as she was driving home.
We talked about what happened throughout the day and what we did with the suspects. He wanted to know if they confessed to any of the robberies, and then I was asking him about what his Boy Scout meeting and everything went with the kids.
Did y'all often have these types of conversations?
Yes, sir.
Would you usually call him or would he call you?
He would call me.
And what generally would he be doing when he called?
Usually he would just be leaving the gym or a store.
She said she didn't call him often because she knew it was wrong and she never knew where he was, so he always called her. She said nothing unusual happened during her drive home. She was still on the phone with Martin when she pulled into her parking garage. She told the jury she drove up to the third floor to park her truck, although she said she now knows that it was actually the fourth floor. She denied ever pulling off to the side, as the prosecution had said, and she said there's actually nowhere to even pull over. She said she stayed on the phone for a few minutes after backing her truck into a parking spot. She said she parked right in front of the door and that she thought how lucky she was because she wouldn't have to carry her equipment too far. She said she typically carries her equipment on her left arm and then uses her right hand to put the key in the lock and then turn it to the left to open. "You've told us how you normally open that door, but it didn't happen that way that day, did it?" Shook asked her. "No," she said, and shook her head, crying. Shook had her stand up and show the jury how she was carrying her equipment. Amber was sobbing at this point, and the prosecutor asked if they could take a break. "No," Amber said. It sounded like she said she wanted to keep going, but it was hard to hear as she cried. The judge then ordered a recess over her objections.
All right.
When they got back from break, Amber was more composed this time around as she put her equipment on her left arm the way she had it as she came to the door that night. She said she took her keys out of her front right pocket. As she was inserting the key, she saw that the door was cracked open. She could hear loud shuffling and someone walking inside what she thought was her apartment. When she put the key in, it forced the door open. She said everything happened all at once, in less than 2 seconds. She told the court that she was scared to death. Her heart rate was skyrocketing, and it's a feeling you never want to feel again, she said.
I compare it to being into a car wreck. Right before you hit that car, you literally just, everything freezes up inside your body. You don't know what's going to happen next. It's just fear, pure fear inside of you.
Okay. Was there a light on inside your apartment?
No.
Or what you believe was your apartment?
No, there was not.
As that door began to open, what were you looking for? What was going through your mind?
My cat. Since I knew somebody was moving around inside my apartment, I wanted just to find that threat.
Okay. What were you feeling?
Fear, scared as crap.
Okay. As the door opened, did you see anything in your apartment?
Whenever I fully opened the door, I saw this silhouette figure standing in the back of the apartment by the window.
You're saying figure?
Yes.
Okay.
She said she drew her weapon and then yelled at him.
It's like, let me see your hands. Let me see your hands.
What was the figure doing?
It moving around.
Okay. Did that cause you some concern?
Yes.
Why is that?
I couldn't see his hands.
How fast is this happening?
Real fast. It's seconds.
Okay. Are you still holding your equipment?
Yes, I am.
How's the door staying open?
I'm using my equipment to prop it open because those doors are heavy.
After she yelled out to him, she said he started coming towards her, and then he yelled at her.
Did you hear anything as he was walking towards you?
There was a loud yell. He was yelling, hey, 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 in an aggressive voice.
She was asked to show how the figure was moving around, and she shuffled from side to side and said,
"It was just moving around. Pacing back and forth."
Okay.
She said she was at the doorway. She remembers feeling that silver bottom thing at her feet.
I have my gun pointed, and I'm saying, let me see your hands. Let me see your hands.
What were you focused on?
Him.
Just him?
Yes.
And then he began coming towards you?
Yes.
And as he became coming toward you, that's when you heard him speak?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to do that now, all right?
Yes, sir.
Hey! Hey! Hey!
And that's at that point whenever I shot.
Somewhere in this area?
Yes.
When you shot, what happened?
He fell down.
She was asked why she fired her gun.
I was scared he was going to kill me.
She then described when she came to the realization that she was in the wrong apartment.
I walked fully inside the apartment. I still had my gun outside since I didn't even, at that point, I didn't know if it wasn't if he was armed. It wasn't to that point when I got to the counter area when everything started, realizing that I wasn't even, this wasn't my apartment.
What did you start noticing?
I started noticing the ottoman in the middle of the floor.
Okay. Now, did you see any lights in the apartment this time?
I finally saw that there was the TV light was on.
Is that the first time you noticed that?
Yes, it was.
Prior to that, where had your complete attention been?
On the threat, on the person that I thought was inside my apartment.
As you saw the ottoman and you moved closer to this person laying on the ground, what's the next thing you saw or felt?
What do you mean? Or
as you're getting closer, what was going through your mind?
As I was getting closer, that's when it started hitting me that this guy, I have no idea who he is. And that's when everything it started to spin. I was confused. And that's when I dialed 911.
She said she was kneeling down next to him as she was calling 911. She was trying to process what happened. She knew she had shot him, but she wasn't sure where he was hit.
I started doing some compressions with my left hand.
What were you doing with your right hand?
I was on the phone with 911.
Is that when we first hear the 911, when the operator picks up?
Yes, sir.
You were trying to do a compression with your left hand?
Yes.
Had you ever done CPR before?
No, I have not.
Did you do that very long?
No, I did not.
What caused you to stop? What caused you to stop doing CPR when you were on 911?
Dispatcher asked me where I was at. I had no idea where I was at. I had to get up and go outside and look at what apartment number I was.
And that's what we hear on the 911 tape when you finally find the number?
Yes, sir.
How did you do that?
I stepped outside and just looked up, and that's when I saw I was in 1478.
And did you tell the operator that at that time?
Yes.
And then what did you do next?
I went back to Mr. John.
She said she doesn't remember turning on the lights. She has no idea when she did that, but she knows she did it after the shooting. As she was sitting by him, she said she started to do what's called a sternum rub, rubbing his sternum with her fist. She said she has seen paramedics do that before, and that it usually wakes someone up when they're unconscious. She said she knew that although he was a little conscious, it wasn't good. When she heard the arriving officers' radios echoing through the hallway, she went out there so they would know where she was. She was asked why she was sending text messages to Martin while on the phone with 911.
I was by myself and with someone I had just shot. I didn't have the help of another partner to help me with the CPR on him. I was alone with him, and that's the scariest thing you can ever imagine. I just wanted help. I wanted someone there, and he was the first one, my partner I trusted, that I could know he could be there for me.
And as for deleting those text messages...
I deleted them. I was ashamed I was in a relationship. I was in a relationship with him. It's embarrassing.
Had you deleted his text before?
Yes, I have.
That's your
normal routine? Yes, it was.
After Amber was done testifying, Prosecutor Hermes did the cross-examination.
One of the things that you obviously wanted to communicate to the jury is just about how bad you feel about what you did to Mr. Jean. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, on the actual day, on September the 6th, 2018, you were captured a lot on body cam. Isn't that correct?
Yes, it's
and
true.
And in-car video. Isn't that right?
Yes.
He showed Sergeant Valentine's in-car video from when she's pulling the car around to put Amber inside, where Amber is surrounded by her friends and hugging them.
You remember you were talking about how alone you felt out there at the scene?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I think you even told the jury you being allowed out there with him, alone with him, was the scariest thing you can imagine. Because you couldn't find a partner or anything? Remember saying that to the jury?
When I was inside the apartment, I was alone.
Exactly. That's the scariest thing you can imagine, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, can you imagine Mr. Jean's perspective? An intruder barging into his apartment? Somebody on the other side of that door being you, going in with the purpose of finding the threat and taking care of it, and then having been shot and fallen and being alone in that apartment? Can't you imagine that being a little bit scarier than you just being alone at the moment?
Yes, sir, I can.
So that would probably be the scariest thing you can imagine.
That's how I felt at the time.
I understand how you felt, but you've told the jury because, see, Ms. Geiger, you are very concerned about how you feel, right?
No.
Can you imagine what that man felt?
That's what hurts.
So let's look at this video, State's Exhibit Number 10. That's all your friends that have come there for your comfort, right?
I didn't ask them to come.
That doesn't matter to me. They're there for your comfort and you're taking advantage of it.
No, sir.
He then switches to the in-car video where she's sitting inside the vehicle with Sergeant Valentine.
That's you talking, right?
Yes, sir.
You're not crying like you are today. You're asking her, should I keep this thing rolling? What are you talking about?
It's a in-car video.
Right. So you're talking normally, and you say, should I keep this thing rolling?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and Sergeant Valentine tells you, yeah, keep it rolling, but just don't say anything, right?
Yes, she does.
Okay.
In the next part of the video, Amber leaves the car, but then quickly ducks back inside. Prosecutor Hermes pointed out that the reason she gets back in is because they're carrying Beau's body out right then. As soon as the body passed by, he noted that she started texting again on her phone.
What made you get in the car was them bringing the body down and walking right past you, isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
All right, then. I'm going to watch it one more time. Mr. Jean is lying on a stretcher being carried by paramedics, right?
Yes, sir.
You can see what you've done. The second he's passed, what do you go do again?
I looked at my phone because I didn't want to see his body.
Looks like you're starting to text somebody again, right?
I looked down at my phone. Don't know what I was doing. It's hard.
Do you see your thumbs moving like you're scrolling around?
Yes, I do. I don't know what I'm looking at.
Prosecutor Hermes said that although she told the jury on direct examination that the reason she deleted the text with Martin is because she felt ashamed about her relationship with him, she was again sending him flirtatious text messages just 2 days later on September 8th.
I mean, how long does this remorse on your part, of this feeling about that what you've been doing is wrong, how long did that last? A day or two?
It lasted every day.
So as this family is thinking about having to bury their son and their brother, 2 days after the event, you are already going back to talking about getting drunk and doing sexual things with Martin Rivera.
Yes, they did.
He then focused on her 911 call.
What you didn't say to the call taker not one single time was that he was coming at me. You didn't say that, did you?
I didn't say it, but I know he did.
Ms. Geiger, I'm just going to ask you to answer my questions, okay?
Yes, sir.
You didn't express one time that you shot him because he was coming at you.
I did not on the phone.
You did. Sorry?
I did not over the phone.
You did not express one time that he was armed.
I did not.
You didn't say one time that he put you in fear.
I did not.
Also, when officers Blair and Lee arrived and came in, you met them in the hallway.
Yes, I did.
You also told them that you shot a person thinking that they were, that this person was in your apartment.
I did tell them that.
You didn't say one time, I thought he was armed, did you?
I did not.
You didn't say one time he was coming at me, did you?
I did not.
And he was still alive, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And if you really, truly, in your heart of hearts, believed that he had had a weapon or that he was really a threat, you would have told them, listen, I haven't patted him down. I haven't searched him. And I think he might have a weapon. That's what you'd do for a fellow officer, wouldn't you?
I couldn't. What I felt at that time is what I felt.
Prosecutor Hermes then brought up her CPR efforts.
Ms. Geiger, were you trained to do CPR properly?
Yes, we were.
Okay. Were you at those classes?
Yes, I was.
Were you paying attention during those classes?
Yes, I was.
Did you properly perform CPR on Mr. John?
No, I did not.
And you could have, right?
I tried to do a little CPR.
Why would you try and do a little CPR on a man who's dying who needs your full attention?
Because I had to keep getting up to see where I was at.
That was more important than giving life-saving help to this man.
I had no idea where I was at.
You were able to tell the 911 call taker very, very soon on that you were in apartment 1478. After that moment, why couldn't you have given him full, undivided, and proper attention?
I was still on the phone with...
You can put the phone on speakerphone, ma'am.
I had so much stuff racing through my head.
Oh, obviously. You were also able, at least on two occasions, to... you must have stopped completely giving him CPR when you sent a message to Martin Rivera saying, I need you, hurry, right?
I did text him that.
Okay, and so you must have, at that point, stopped CPR entirely.
Yes, I did.
And then, not even a minute later, you must have stopped CPR entirely again to send a second message to Martin Rivera.
I was already out in the hallway.
Oh, so you had already left him.
That's whenever they told me to leave, the officers.
So that's, no... Ma'am, I'm talking about 10.03 p.m. Mr. Lee, Officer Lee, and Officer Blair didn't arrive until almost 10.05.
Yes, I do remember that. Like, whenever they showed me, I sent those text messages.
At 10.03 p.m. and at 10.02 p.m., you sent messages, text messages to Martin Rivera.
Yes, I did.
Text messages that would have required you to have put the phone in a place where you can see it, and you used your fingers to write out the words, I need you, hurry, dot, 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 right?
I don't remember how many hands I used.
But you texted Mr. Rivera using your hands.
Yes, I did.
And as you were doing that, you were unable to give Mr. John your full attention, the attention that he deserved.
Yes, I did.
And then you made the choice to do that a second time. Isn't that true?
Yes, sir.
All right, so at both of those times, you put your needs and your wants over his.
I still cared about him.
Did you put your needs and your wants over him when you decided to do that?
No, sir.
All right. And then you went out into the hall. You left him alone.
When I heard the officers coming, I stepped outside.
So you decided to do something other than continue to give Mr. Jean life-saving measures.
I wanted somebody there fast to get him
You're
out.
You're not answering my questions, are you?
Yes, sir, I am.
When you went out into the hall, you did that because that was what you chose to do, even though you knew you should be giving that man life-saving treatment.
Yes, sir.
You didn't know that he was going to die. I mean, you knew he was in really bad shape, right?
Yes.
You didn't know at that moment in time that you had actually shot him and severed his ventricle from his heart. You didn't know that, right?
No, I did not.
In those moments, you know as a trained officer just how critical it is to make sure that you give life-saving treatment as fast and as proper as possible so you can maximize their ability to survive. You know that.
Yes, sir.
And yet, despite knowing that repeatedly, you made choices and decisions that suited you more than him.
No, sir.
He then pointed out that there was no blood on her uniform or shoes. She agreed and said, "There is not." She was asked how long Beau was pacing back and forth for, and she said maybe 2 or 3 seconds. He questioned why a bullet hole would be so far away from where she claimed he was standing. "That I cannot explain," she said. "I'm not an expert in that." Prosecutor Hermes told her it was physically impossible. He then asked about the trajectory of the bullet and how the medical examiner said it went in a downward path. He had her stand up and point her finger as though she was pointing her gun.
"Mr. Jean is a good 4 inches taller than me. In order for that bullet to have gone into him at that angle, he must have been bent over something like this, right?"
"I don't know what he was."
"If you saw the trajectory that the medical examiner testified to, do you have any reason to think that the medical examiner is lying?"
"I don't."
"But your testimony is that he was standing straight up looking you in the eye or looking right at you when you shot him in the chest?"
"Yes, sir, when I saw him. It's the last thing I saw."
He told her she knew when she shot that gun that she was using deadly force, and she agreed, saying that he was a threat at that time.
"So all this stuff about it being a sad mistake, at the moment in time when rubber meets the road, when you pulled that trigger, you intended to kill Mr. John?"
"He was the threat, yes, sir."
"Will you answer my question? When you aimed and pulled the trigger at Mr. John, shooting him in center mass exactly where you are trained, you intended to kill Mr. John?"
"I did."
He then asked her why none of the neighbors who testified, the closest neighbors they could find, he said, heard her say anything prior to shooting. "I can't tell you why," she said. "It's because you didn't say it," he responded. "Not true, sir," she said. He also confronted her about her testimony that she drove straight up to the fourth floor without pulling over after pulling into the parking garage. He said her truck pulled into the parking lot, per surveillance cameras, at 9:46 p.m., Ronald Jones entered at 9:53 p.m., 7 minutes later. Jones testified that he saw her truck park after he did. Prosecutor Hermes asked if Jones is lying. She said she can't answer that.
"I did back up into my truck and stay on the phone."
"All right, but you're gonna stick with that. You did not pull over."
"I do not ever remember pulling over."
Prosecutor Hermes then showed her the email that her building had sent out the week of the shooting, telling tenants that maintenance would be going into the apartments. She admitted that there was no time listed in the email. On direct examination, Amber had said she was concerned because of robberies and homeless people in the building. Prosecutor Hermes produced an email from August 21st, 2018, where a fellow police officer asked her if she liked her new place, and she responded, "I'm liking it. Few homeless here and there, and a lot of hippies smoking weed." She said she doesn't remember sending that. "But today, in front of this jury, it sounds like a lot of mayhem was going on," he remarked. "Yes, sir," she said. Prosecutor Hermes then went through the backpack she had on her that night. She had put it down next to Beau after she shot him. He pointed out that she had combat gauze inside for use in controlling traumatic bleeding.
"Would you agree that Mr. Jean was bleeding horribly from the gunshot wound that you put into his chest?"
"I don't recall much blood, sir."
"You were able to tell the responding officers exactly where the bullet wound is. How would you have known that had you not looked?"
"What do you mean? I knew he was shot somewhere."
"You told them exactly where he was shot."
"Top left."
"Right. How would you have known that if you hadn't have looked to where he had been shot?"
"I knew where he was shot."
How? From the time that you shot him?"
No, when I turned on the lights.
Okay, so did you look at the bullet wound?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so you knew he was injured with a bullet, right?
Yes, I did.
And a person bleeds when they're injured with a bullet, correct?
Yes, they do.
Is there a reason why you didn't use this stuff right here, which is designed to control traumatic bleeding?
It never crossed my mind.
It didn't even cross your mind?
No, sir.
Even though he's bleeding in front of you?
No.
And this is inches from you?
It did not cross
my mind. It never crossed your mind to use this?
No, sir.
He asked if other than CPR with one hand, did you do anything else to help him? Sternum rub, she replied. Mark Lipscomb is a private equity attorney who was once a resident at the Southside Flats. He testified on behalf of the defense and told the jury that he had parked on the wrong floor of the parking garage on a number of occasions. He also recalled one time after going out to walk his dog, accidentally walking into someone else's apartment. He said he went up one flight of stairs instead of two, opened the door, which was unlocked, and went inside. He walked all the way in and didn't realize he was in the wrong apartment until he saw a woman he didn't know sitting on the couch. He said it was an embarrassing moment. Jessica Martinez, an art teacher and coach, also lived at the Southside Flats. She said she had problems with her apartment keys not working properly, and she also testified that homeless people repeatedly got into the complex. She recalled how one day she was sitting on her couch when a strange man wandered in with a key. She said she believed he was homeless. Another time, she recounted how she parked on the wrong floor of the garage and she didn't realize it until she was walking down the hallway. Amy Rose had a similar story for the jury. She said she parked on the wrong floor of the garage and walked down the wrong hallway to what she thought was her apartment. She said even though a decorative urn that was normally on the floor wasn't there, and even though she didn't see her doormat outside of what she thought was her door, she still didn't realize her mistake. In fact, she said it wasn't until she looked up at the apartment numbers that she noticed she was on the wrong floor. Officer Keenan Blair testified that he was the very first officer who arrived on the scene. He had arrived with Officer Lee, but he was the first upstairs. He told the jury that although he did CPR on Bo, he didn't get blood on his hands from that. He said it was only when he touched the wound. He also testified that police officers have different mindsets when they're on duty versus when they're off duty, and that an off-duty officer reacting to a perceived intruder would be different than an on-duty officer reacting to a burglary call. The on-duty officer responding to a call would have more time to plan a reaction. And David Armstrong, the Texas Ranger, who is also the lead investigator on the case, was recalled to the stand, this time by the defense. He was asked to talk about, generally speaking, what sensations a person might experience when confronted with a quickly evolving tense dynamic confrontation with a suspect. He testified that that person may experience auditory exclusion, tunnel vision, short-term memory loss, and an elevated heart rate. Before Judge Kemp gave the jury their instructions and before the attorneys gave their closing arguments, she ruled that they would be allowed to consider Texas's Castle Doctrine, which says that someone can reasonably use deadly force if four criteria are met. One, if they believe that someone is on their property illegally. Two, if they reasonably believe that deadly force is immediately necessary. Three, they did not provoke the person. And four, they were not committing a crime at the time deadly force was used. Judge Kemp said the law could apply as if Amber were acting in her own home. She also ruled that the jury would be able to consider manslaughter. In their closing arguments, prosecutor Jason Fine called Amber's testimony garbage.
I never want anybody to ever have to go through or even imagine going through what I felt that night. That was one of the very last things the defendant said when she was on the stand. Are you kidding? That is garbage. most of what she said was garbage.
He said what she did was not a mistake, but that it was a series of unreasonable decisions. He also had some harsh words about the Castle Doctrine in this case. Quote, it protects homeowners against intruders, and now all of a sudden, the intruder is trying to use it against the homeowner. This law is not in place for her. It's in place for Beau. Amber's attorney, Toby Shook, argued in his closing arguments that the only evidence that matters is what led up to Amber opening the door and shooting Beau, that her actions afterwards, whether she performed CPR, whether she followed police procedure, and whether she was in a relationship with a married man, none of that matters, he said. He also brought up the testimony of the other residents who had made mistakes about which floor they were on or which apartment was theirs. The law recognizes that mistakes can be made, he said. The jury deliberated for a little less than 24 hours before finding Amber guilty of murder. At the sentencing hearing, prosecutors introduced several text message conversations that Amber had with her friends. One text conversation was in January 2015, when Amber and her fellow police officers were working the Martin Luther King Jr. Day Parade. Amber received a text message that said, "When does this end, LOL?" Amber replied, "When MLK is dead, dot, dot, dot. Oh, wait." In March 2018, Amber's partner, Martin Rivera, texted her, "Damn, I was at this area with five different black officers. Not racist, but damn." Amber responded, "Not racist, but just have a different way of working, and it shows." Then, 2 days prior to shooting Beau, someone text messaged Amber about giving her a German Shepherd. "Although she may be racist," the person wrote. "I wish I could have one," Amber responded, "but not in this apartment, smaller than my old one." She then added, "It's okay, I'm the same." Beau's family members took turns taking the stand, testifying about their love for Beau and how much they miss him. Beau's father talked about how he used to talk to his son every Sunday. "My Sundays have been destroyed," he said. He hung his head and cried while he spoke about the day he had to bury his son. Beau's brother, Brant John, not only spoke about his brother, but he also had a message for Amber. He forgives her. "If you go to God and ask him, he will forgive you," he said. He told her he loves her, just like anyone else.
"I'm not gonna say I hope you rot and die, just like my brother did, but I personally want the best for you. And I wasn't gonna ever say this in front of my family or anyone, but I don't even want you to go to jail. I want the best for you because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. And the best would be give your life to Christ. I'm not going to say anything else. I think giving your life to Christ would be the best thing that both of them would want you to do."
He asked Judge Kemp if he could hug Amber. "Please," he asked. Judge Kemp agreed, and he got up and he and Amber embraced. Sobs broke out in the courtroom. Members of Amber's family also spoke at her sentencing. They told the jury that Amber does feel remorse, that she has changed since the incident happened, and that she even expressed a desire to have been able to switch places with Beau. Her sister testified that Amber feels bad spending time with her own family because Beau can't be with his. Prosecutors asked the jury to sentence Amber to 28 years in prison, the age Beau would be if he were still alive today. The jury had the choice of a minimum of 5 years or a maximum of 99 years. They deliberated for about an hour and a half before returning their verdict of 10 years. Shortly after the trial ended, a complaint was filed against Judge Tammy Kemp by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. During the sentencing hearing, Judge Kemp walked over to Amber and handed her a Bible, reading her a passage from it. They spoke for about 4 minutes and then hugged. Judge Kemp then walked over and hugged members of Amber's family as well. Andrew Seidel, a constitutional attorney from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, explained to the Law and Crime Network why they filed the complaint.
Basically, what happened yesterday at the conclusion of the trial, it appears that the judge kind of got caught up and swept up in the emotion of the trial, eventually went back to her chambers, grabbed her Bible, came back out, gave it to Amber Geiger, instructed her on how to read it, told her to read the Gospels, to read John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, and really had this intense moment of proselytizing and witnessing to not just the defendant, but everybody really who was in that courtroom. As you can see, she's in her robes. There are armed guards standing there. It is happening in the courtroom. So she's acting in her official capacity as a judge, and she is promoting her personal religion. So she's abusing an office that belongs to we the people to promote her personal religion. And that was the real problem for us.
The majority of this episode was about Beau's death and Amber's trial. But I want to include a clip of Beau in life, doing what he loved. The Law and Crime Network put together a video of Beau using videos taken from his college, Harding University, where he was an active singer and wrote church songs.
Botham John. A life ended with tragedy, a legacy of hope.
Just a little talk with Jesus makes it right.
As I was recording this episode, news broke about another death involving someone in this case. On October 5th, 2019, Joshua Brown, Beau's 28-year-old neighbor who testified on behalf of the state, that he heard two people meeting by surprise and then gunshots. The witness who cried on the stand when he recalled how Beau sang every morning. Joshua was shot to death himself outside of another apartment complex he was currently living at. Police have since made 3 arrests in the case. According to S. Lee Merritt, the attorney who represented the Jean family, Joshua Brown's family is requesting that the Dallas Police Department recuse themselves from investigating Joshua's case. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think. Did you believe Amber's testimony? Do you agree with the verdict and the sentencing? What would you have done if you were a juror in this case? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Also, if you'd like to hear these episodes ad-free, head on over to courtjunkie.com/support, and you'll be directed to my Patreon page, where you can also get access to monthly bonus episodes at the $6 and $10 a month levels. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Until next time.